are still in our origin series, where we're looking at stories from the book of Genesis, the origins of our faith, which each tells a story about how these things got started. We're using a commentary by a social ethicist, Miguel de la Torre, and he begins in that text. He says that Genesis answers and asks the big questions. Why are we here? How are we to relate to one another because that we were here? And in the story that Elizabeth read for us this morning, he says that Genesis asks another really big question through the voice of our scripture. Am I my brother's keeper? Miguel de la Torre says and rephrases, am I my sibling's keeper? And he says the rest of Genesis, well, really the rest of the Bible is dedicated to answering that question. And so this morning, as we think about our brothers, our sisters, our siblings who were murdered over this weekend, we hold that question with us. And that question is a point of departure for where we begin our faith. Am I my sibling's keeper? As a part of this Origin Stories series, we've been hearing from a lot of our different members who have told us their stories about their identities, how they've gotten into the work that they do, or how they understand their families. And of course, we plan this conversation today with Carrie Zimmerman and Chris Norris before we knew about the events of this weekend. But as I think about it, I'm really grateful to be having a conversation with the two of you on this Sunday morning. I'll introduce them and then we'll get into our conversation. Chris and Carrie are very similar in a lot of ways, and also pretty different too. They'll say more about the similarities, but I'll just say this. They both grew up like an hour apart from each other off of Interstate 40, and they rejected my attempt to name this sermon after Interstate 40. So I just want to put that out there, you know.
We were promised cans of Chirwan
during
the Sunday that we were...
That is, yeah, wow, wow. Very public. I'll get y'all on the cheer wine next time. I really did. I did promise them that. That's true. both grew up.
For those who don't know, that's a North Carolina soft drink, cherry flavor. That's like the
magic.
Best thing in the world. Yeah.
There are also many North Carolinians in, you know, this congregation, and so, you know. But it's really exciting to have you all be our conversation partners this morning. And part of the reason it is, you know, both Chris and Carrie, and I've said this to them a number of times, are white Southerners from small towns in North Carolina. But yet they both find themselves vocationally doing work of racial justice. Carrie does so as a consultant to colleges, universities, and really any other organizations to help them think about what it means to build a truly diverse and inclusive and justice-oriented sort of organizational culture and work. And you really spend your days, and I really say this, you know, Carrie's sort of waging the one-woman revolution in the South. She goes, can I say this?
Yeah.
Okay. She goes to basically all of the big SEC schools and helps them to think about what it means to teach their students on issues of social justice. And she has this audience and this platform where you're really provoking the minds of students and have access to really many of the incoming freshmen across the Southeast and really across the country, and you really have an opportunity to shape their perspective, especially on events like this weekend and days like this weekend. And so we're grateful and want to hear more about your story, Carrie. And then Chris, Chris has an MDiv as well. Carrie also has an MDiv from TCU. Chris has an MDiv from Duke, and then you went on to do your PhD at the University of Virginia, which was founded by Thomas Jefferson, and it's in Charlottesville, Virginia. And it was there at UVA that Chris has ended up sort of becoming a theologian and an ethicist, but a lot of his work is now focused on Black liberation theology, right? And so the very reason that I pulled these two people together is I want to know how the two white Southerners from North Carolina who spend their Thanksgiving at the K&W in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. I didn't even know what that was. Look, there's much to talk about, y'all. How do y'all end up on this path that you're on doing this work that you do? And I'll turn it over to y'all.
Y'all, I feel like we have to start with the good y'all. When we were first asked to do this, I think Chris and I both voiced some sense of uncomfortability. I felt unsettled. I felt this sense of, am I a person who can and should talk about this? In every area of my life except my gender, I'm in the majority. I am in a power position in every other category in my life. I'm educated. I'm white. I had a family that was together and loved me. I'm cisgendered and heterosexual and Christian. And in every category, I have been in the majority. And so the discomfort sort of started with, I shouldn't be the one with the microphone. Other people ought to have a moment to share their voice. And Chris will talk some about his discomfort and where that comes from. But it felt a sense of, are we the right people? As a white Southern woman, should I be even talking about this? And I'm brought back to a story earlier this year. Where's Lauren? Lauren was part of this conversation that I had. I work with universities around the country and do what Elijah said. They bring me in to help them say to incoming freshmen, what do we value? What does community look like? How do we respond when our community is unjust? What do we do when there's a hate crime or a bias act on our campus? What do we do? How does that work? And I write readers' theaters that juniors and seniors in college perform for freshmen at orientation. And I did a little math earlier this week. Of the schools that I've worked with this year from January until now, 110,000 freshmen will hear what these upper class students are now preaching to the freshmen. And I say it's preaching because that's what I think they're doing. Wow. So my job is to train these upper class, 110,000. I had no idea what the number was until I was like, that's a
one
big
woman.
That's a big number. That's a big number. And at some of the schools, they have agreed to go full in all the way. When we list hate crimes on campuses, we use the real words and all the language and the things that people of color are called and immigrants are called and women are called. And so in this one university in Deep South Georgia, where I will actually be tomorrow, they use the N-word in their script because it's an example that is shouted at a student. And we've done it for 7 years, and this year I got pushback from an administrator who was like, that's too complicated. Let's just pull that example. So I went to particularly women of color who I have respect for and trust, and Lauren helps me talk through this conversation. I came to her and I came to a dean of students at a different university, and I said to them, I'm being told we can't use this. It's too hard. And both Lauren and my friend, Dean Patrice Buckner Jackson, said to me, you have to. We have to say the words. Yes, it's hard. Yes, it's uncomfortable. We have to say it. We have to have the conversation. And I sobbed in this phone call where I thought, of course we have to. It doesn't matter how uncomfortable it is. We have to. And so knowing that, where we're sitting here, understanding what level of privilege we both come to this with, I also feel a deep, deep responsibility because of my origin story, I think. And I'll let Chris talk about some of his discomfort, and then we'll move into the origins.
Yeah, yeah. I think we both wanted to begin by kind of naming that, that when Elijah approached us to do this, we both kind of thought, you know, probably some other people who might be more appropriate for this. And so I'll name a couple levels of discomfort. One, I think it's just with the events with doing this today. I mean, I think anybody who is speaking or involved in kind of church service today after the events of yesterday is going to have some level of discomfort with doing that. I think that it's, I mean, kind of what a day to have as our scripture, the kind of story of the kind of biblical first act of violence on a day after 30 people lose their lives, and to sing about that and read about it and kind of reflect on what that event was, and as we'll kind of talk about a little later, was not only an act of violence, but one that was kind of derived out of a sense of kind of prejudice for another person. And so we'll kind of talk about that a little bit later. But then also kind of on a personal level, just sort of like what Carrie was saying, I think we both think that for all the reasons that Carrie named and other ones, that the work that we do isn't all that risky. I mean, we're both in higher education. I'm in academics, and so I teach classes on church and politics and race, and currently working on a book on white supremacy and white theology and white church practice. But really, to do that, it's not super costly for me. I sit in my apartment or in a coffee shop, and I read books and write books about white supremacy. You know, it doesn't come with much cost there. And so I think just to kind of name that in some ways there are people who are in other positions with other vocations, under other social conditions for which kind of doing some type of activism or some type of anti-racist work within your vocation or whatever might be more risky than it is for us. I just wanted to kind of name that. But like Elijah and Carrie said, we kind of both come from pretty similar backgrounds and similar origins, and so I think we'll talk a little bit about that if Carrie wants to start.
So I grew up in small town North Carolina, Valdez, North Carolina, and we did joke about the fact that he wanted to name the sermon something about Interstate 40. Well, I had a cat named Interstate 40, so that just felt weird. So we're like, no, we'll skip that. So we were really 20, 25 miles apart down the same interstate, didn't know each other, and we discovered in a conversation earlier this month that we probably ate Thanksgiving dinner together at some point in North Myrtle Beach at the K&W cafeteria. Because our families both did that. We were like, wait, you ate where? So we probably, you know, broke bread over turkey and canned cranberry sauce at some point. Since we started this sermon series about origin stories, I really have been thinking about mine and where I come from and where my family is from and what that means. And I've come to a couple of realizations. Small town, my town was entirely white within the city limits. Entirely. 3,000 people. When my parents moved there from Atlanta in 1962 for my father's job, they were wooing my dad for this position. And the upper echelon of the community hosted a lovely dinner. And at some point, they take the men to one room for, I don't know, brandy and cigars if we're on Mad Men. I don't know what they were doing. The men went to one room, the women went to the other, and they were trying to convince both of them about what a perfect place Valdez was to grow up. And the women in my mother's room were like, you'll love Valdez. It's beautiful. We have parks and excellent elementary schools, and it's safe, and there are trees and mountains, and it's just so beautiful. And there's a bakery and homemade shops, and there's not a colored person that lives within the city limits. And that was a selling point for them. And my mother, who it was not a selling point for, almost lost the job offer because she says, well, hopefully we can come and help change that. So there's a little snapshot of part of my origin story. And part of it is I had progressive, liberal, but white, privileged Southern parents who loved Jesus deeply. And in my growing up, I came to know very early on that we weren't like most of the people in our town. frequently around our dinner table were conversations of, we don't say that word and here's why. We don't do this and this is why. You know, my mother saying to me early on, oh, gay men will be some of your best friends. And I very quickly realized other people's parents in my small town weren't saying that to them. No. Like, no. And when she said gay men, I don't think she meant to exclude anybody. She just, they were some of her best friends. And so in that, you know, I was, we're all in our kind of blissful bubble as a small child if your home is safe, and mine was. And I did not realize until I saw more of the world, more people, that while I was hearing lots about equality and love, and it was all theoretical, because I wasn't having to make any hard decisions because everybody in my elementary school looked like me. Everyone in my church looked like me. And so while I had an intellectual understanding of difference, I didn't have any personal understanding of what it was. And as we talked about what brought us to this work, I realized that mine was not about racial justice. It was about LGBTQ justice, because I knew people who were gay and hurting, and that the church had hurt. So it felt personal to me. It wasn't until I moved away from my small town and went to college that I went, oh, it's a whole world of this hurt and pain and every type of that. The second thing I realized in thinking about my origin story is that, you know, we all rewrite our own history. We all rewrite it to make it be what we makes us look good or feel better. And I realized that the only stories I told about my family were like the one I just told about my mother. They were the ones about my grandfather as a judge in little bitty small town Metter, Georgia, who they had a plank sidewalk that the white people could walk on around the square, and there was a dirt trail beside it that all the black people walked on. And my grandfather, the one county judge, wouldn't walk on the sidewalk, the plank sidewalk. And my mother asked him, hey, Pop, why don't we walk on the sidewalk? And he said, according to family lore, honey, we don't walk on the sidewalk until everybody can walk on the sidewalk. Now, that's the stories that we tell about our family, but it's not the whole truth. It's not the wholeness of the fact that we weren't questioning systems that were benefiting us. We weren't, you know, I didn't go back far enough to go, all right, Metter, Georgia in the South by plantations. Who farther back in my family owned other human beings? We tell the things that make us look better. So I, in the process of this, have really begun to dig into, all right, what's the wholeness of my origin? And I have felt a responsibility to live up to the parts that have made me proud and identify the parts that I'm not proud of. So this, looking into origin stories, I realized fully informed the work that I do today. Who I am, what I do, how I spend my days is because of the expectations that were set for me by people around me. I am standing on the shoulders of people who before me, in whatever time period they were in, said, this is not okay. So I owe that to them because I benefited from that. It also has helped me address anger, deep anger, that I have for people who grew up around me who are choosing to not see the pain, the hurt, the injustice, the systems. And I'm realizing I heard things at an early developmental age that other people didn't hear. So that was the beginning, is that I came from people who, although they taught and loved, and it was from the basis of Christ. It was, God loves all, so we love all. I also recognized that we were doing that from a real place of comfortability. That's easy to do in white, small town. Became easy, even as Confederate flags flew on the backs of pickup trucks. It was easier to do because it was safe there for me.
Yeah, so like Carrie said, I grew up probably 30 minutes down Interstate 40 from her. We're both from kind of hill country, North Carolina.
And a road or the cat.
The road.
Both.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. 30 minutes from the cat also. Yeah.
It's a great cat.
And so we have some similarities there, kind of growing up within the kind of system of white supremacy that's in kind of Southern culture for sure, but also some differences. I grew up in a pretty conservative Southern Baptist church. And so I had a kind of more conservative upbringing where, you know, no one in kind of my family or my church or anything was like explicitly racist, but we just didn't talk about that stuff. It was just the kind of thing that just was not on the radar at all. I went to the city school in Statesville, which was about half white and half black. And so I was kind of exposed to that in a way. I think that Carrie's story is a little different, but I remember, you know, going into the lunchroom where it was completely segregated, and I sat with the white kids from the Statesville Country Club, and all the kind of black kids sat together on the other side of the cafeteria. And so the only kind of points of interaction that really happened were just through sports and that kind of thing. Then went on to went to the University of North Carolina, to Duke, to Emory, which is a kind of white marbled school in the middle of Atlanta, and then UVA. So all Southern, very white institutions. It was part of the Baptist student ministry at UNC, which was also kind of predominantly white. And all the churches that I worked in during my seminary experience, I didn't do kind of inner city or kind of urban ministry. I worked in predominantly white churches. So despite some of that upbringing, never having kind of questioned that, I was very much ingrained in kind of white culture throughout all that. So I'll tell kind of three quick anecdotes to kind of explain some of that. So one of the first, also one kind of growing up in the Southern Baptist Church, kind of right outside of Statesville, we did a lot of kind of mission work in the city and doing kind of working at soup kitchens and that kind of thing to kind of give back to the city. But the fact that most of the kind of people who came through the homeless shelter through the soup kitchen were persons of color was not something that was even addressed. We were helping the kind of poor people, but no questioning about why they were poor or why most of the poor people in Statesville were not white. And so, again, just kind of barriers to that next level of questioning about what was happening. Like I said, I mentioned one of the only times that there was kind of broke through some of the kind of segregation in high school was through sports, and so I played basketball. And I remember one time going to the summer basketball team camp, and I was the only white person who got on the bus to go to summer camp there with an all-black basketball team. But what I remember about that is how, like, initially how completely uncomfortable I was doing it. It was the first time that I'd ever been in a situation where I was really part of the kind of extreme minority in a situation. But obviously not questioning or thinking about the fact that this is what all the other people on the bus who live in a kind of white majority city and kind of culture have to experience all the time. Again, that kind of level self-reflection was not there. And then the third kind of example of that, I think, is after I finished it at Duke and took a pastorate at a church that was kind of right outside of Raleigh. So a kind of between Raleigh and Gardner, people who knew that area. So pretty diverse area. It was a kind of blue collar church. We met in the Woodsmen of the World Lodge, kind of right off of the interstate, and had actually a pretty diverse congregation. Had a lot of Latino and black people who lived in the neighborhood. The leadership of that church wanted to relocate into the to the southwest side of Raleigh, like in the Cary area, the Research Triangle Park, and wanted to attract like young professionals, which you is. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, although never saying that at all. And I thought that it was a bad idea. We had kind of a cool thing going there, and they were not the kind of church with their like contemporary worship and egg shakers and stuff like that. That was actually going to like bring in the kind of like young professionals in the Research Triangle anyway. And so I opposed the idea, but didn't at all think about this. Even then, after seminary education at Duke, didn't even think about this in kind of racial terms. That what they were really trying to do was bring in more wealthier white people into the congregation, and was just kind of oblivious to that. And so the point I want to make with all of that is to say, on a day like today where we see the kind of violent impact and effects of white supremacy, and how that white supremacy is not just an ideology or an attitude, but throughout history, from the kind of Atlantic slave trade to Jim Crow and lynching to now, has extremely violent effects and impacts that are there. While the white nationalists who perpetuate these crimes and go into a Walmart or whatever are certainly part of the problem for sure, another part of the problem are people like me growing up and pastoring churches who don't talk about race or think about it and allow the kind of system of white supremacy that I was in and still in to kind of block us from talking about and raising questions about why injustice and inequality exists. Why do we want to move to the Research Triangle Park? Why do I feel discomfort in this situation, but not think about situations where other people are discomfort? So I think some of the part of the problem that we don't often think about when we see headlines and all like we see today or read manifestos or that kind of thing are the kind of regular person in the pew who's not explicitly racist, but maybe tells a racist joke every once in a while, or just doesn't think about things that are happening in churches that don't form and shape people to think and to question why these things are going on and what lies beneath the violence that we saw yesterday.
Well, I want to thank y'all for both of the ways you're sharing. And, you know, what stands out to me as a friend and as someone listening and as someone also deeply invested in this work is you name, you know, the way that colorblindness itself is a type of violence, that you have this identity, this culture, this family, this heritage, all that you connect with and love, but also that you can name, right, doesn't help you to see, right, the people who are right there, right? You named it in Valdez, right? It's no black people within the city limits, but right outside the city limits. And why does the city limits sort of exist like that in the first place, right? But what I want to know from y'all, what I want y'all to help us figure out is so what happened? Both of your lives are very different from your lives in Valdez and Statesville. And even though you push back and say you're uncomfortable, you know, being the voice of this, you know, not every college consultant is pushing their students to see the way that using the word nigger turns into a hate crime, turns into a mass murder. Not every college consultant's doing that. It requires some courage for you to do that. Not every theologian is actually trying to confront white supremacy in moderate to liberal theology. Not everybody's doing that. So why are y'all within your vocation doing this particular work, and how did that spark happen for you?
I can tell you the moment it happened for me, where it went from an intellectual understanding of how this was right or wrong into a very personal understanding. So I went to Vanderbilt University for my undergrad, also a white, Ivy growing institution. And then when I went to divinity school, I had no idea what degree I was going to get, but I started at Southern Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, the flagship Southern Baptist institution. And it was the most miserable 4 months of my entire life. I made it a full-on one semester. And it was the semester that, for those of you who know the crazy Southern Baptist, it was the takeover. It was the semester that the school shut down the first and only at that time school of church social work, with the argument that social work and Christianity are incongruent. I mean, if Jesus was anything, he was a social worker. And so that happened that semester. They required every woman to sign a document saying that she was submissive to her husband and or her pastor, dare she be single. Faculty dropped like flies. They all left and fled, and we were on the news every night, and there was protesting. And I stood back and thought, I don't know what God is here, but it's not one when I leave here, and I will leave here, that I will take with me. And so I knew I was transferring. I knew I needed to be at an ecumenical, diverse institution of different belief systems. And so I also at that moment said, I cannot work in a church. There's something about the church, big C, that's broken. And I thought, but I still feel this call, this God should still be at work in the people. But I was so church angry that I didn't want to be a part of the church. And so I thought, oh, I can get this degree in theology and social justice, but I'm not going to work in a church. Like, I was very adamant about that. I did go to work in a church.
Of course I did.
But as their community minister, so my job was to run their homeless center. And that was the moment where I saw community differently. I was in Fort Worth, Texas. It's a very diverse city. And I realized that the community looked and felt different. And so it was a grant-funded position. I'm running a homeless center. I met people who changed my life with their brightness and their perspective and their pain and their hurt. And I will carry their stories within me forever. But then the position disappeared because that's a hard thing to fund. And I went to work at a university back at TCU where I had done my MDiv. And I was working in the student affairs office and I was working with orientation and running these freshman programs. And I literally, from a Friday of running a homeless center to the next Monday morning, had gone from deep poverty, people who could not think past the next meal, to being with extraordinarily wealthy, privileged, almost exclusively white kids who had the world at their fingertips. And it was like emotional and cultural whiplash for me. But I realized very quickly that these students that I grew to love deeply, no one was saying to them, oh, you cannot walk around saying, oh, that test is retarded. You can't walk around saying, oh, this game is gay. I don't want to play that. So mine was a moment where I went, how are we as educators not using the majority of our time to say, these are the kind of people we have to be to build the kind of community that we want? So it was my running away from the church that I actually found God again. And it was a decade of after working at a church and working at church camps my whole life and VBS and my name is carved in the bell tower at the church. It was 10 years that I did not go to church because the church to me was not where God was in that moment. So that was my own journey, and I found it in these conversations with students who wanted their life to matter and to be something, but no one was saying to them, this is how you can do this. And I just thought, why can't I do this? Why can't we spend our time having these conversations? And it also was in a moment in our nation's history when hate crimes, there were not more of them happening, but technologically we were in a moment where we suddenly had proof of them. Everybody had a phone in their pocket. Everybody suddenly had a video, a picture. And so on college campuses, it was when Matthew Shepard was killed. It was when numerous incidences of bias, hate crime, racism, sexism, homophobia suddenly came to national light on college campuses, fraternity hazing events. And again, none of this was new, but suddenly the people who had been shouting, weeping for years of this is happening to us, someone had to listen to them because we had video evidence. And so it wasn't out of the goodness of universities' hearts that they went, we really should start addressing these things. It was that they could no longer deny them. So I found myself, that was my transformational moment where I thought, I cannot be a part of this system. So that was a shift from I love people to I have to love people enough to shift a system so it's fair for them. So that was the moment for me.
Wow. What about you, Chris?
Yeah, so I'll be brief about this because, one, I don't run on time, and I don't think I'm very articulate about whatever transition or transformation happened because it feels in a lot of ways like something that just kind of happened to me rather than something I had a lot of agency or, activity in. So an important but a kind of easy part of the story is to say that I've certainly underwent a transformation on August 12th, 2017, when I was in Charlottesville, so during the kind of white nationalist rally. There being part of the kind of anti-racist protesters and kind of clergy resistance that was there. And the events of that day, just in kind of two ways. One, kind of significantly diminished my hope that racial reconciliation is something that could be accomplished very easily. Also diminished my hope that the churches are going to be a major part of making that happen, as I saw the absence of most all the churches in Charlottesville that just did not participate at all. Most of the people who did participate came from out of town. And so the lack of church engagement there. And then also, but the kind of other part of the coalition of people that was there, of people of many different faiths and no faith at all, kind of coming together. So that. But then also the fact that, like, again, for a day, I was like, I mean, seriously, the, like, scariest day of my life, the whole day, I was, you know, just, you know, kind of frightened as people were, you know, had every single white nationalist person had a club and a helmet or and a shield, and they were like literally like militia people in camouflage with rifles just stationed outside of the like little safe house that we were in after the police dispersed everything. So like very scary. I can talk about that if anybody wants to later, but the point is that for a day I experienced again what I think a lot of people experience all the time, and I as a white person opted into it and could opt out the very next day and suffer no repercussions to that. So that's part of the story. But what I think the like more significant thing is, and in some ways it's kind of a like boring intellectual idea, but going into a PhD program, which was not that long ago, I went there to study church and politics, and I did that because of my experience pastoring that church in Raleigh that was wanted to become young professional, and it was super patriotic in a kind of conservative way. Also, I'd done research at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta when I was there, home of Martin Luther King Jr., the pastor who was there at the time and still was a student of James Cone, who we talk about in church here a lot, the father of black liberation theology. I remember in 2008 going to their like election watch night service where they were celebrating Obama being elected, and I remember feeling very uncomfortable with like a church celebrating a like presidential election. And so I went into a PhD program to study kind of both of those things, how like this sort of engagement with politics and patriotism works in different, very different settings. And so I chose to study James Cone and then a white theologian from Duke who doesn't talk about race but has a kind of certain perspective on politics. And so for most of my PhD program, I was studying church and politics, including a dissertation like on the father of black liberation theology. And in my dissertation proposal, 2,000 word kind of abstract of what it is I'm going to study, I didn't mention race, didn't mention racism, whiteness, blackness, white supremacy. It was like Cone had nothing to do with race at all. 10 days later after that, Darren Wilson was not indicted for the murder of Michael Brown. And that made me think about this and realize like that I had proposed to kind of, to do a dissertation on the father of black liberation theology that didn't talk about whiteness or white supremacy at all. Again, it was just something that because of my focus, I didn't even think about. Also, at the time, I was living across from this elderly couple who were very active in the kind of civil rights struggle in Charlottesville. And I would go over to their house after, you know, class or doing work and sit on the front porch and drink sweet tea. And they would talk about kind of stuff in the very southern kind of stuff in the 1960s, and how his wife, African-American teacher in the school system, had actually was the kind of lead signer on the petition to begin to kind of integrate the schools. And so all these kind of the circle of things kind of happening to me at the same time, I think resulted in me changing to write a dissertation about racism and white supremacy, going to Charlottesville in August of 2017, which is right at the time that I first started coming here to Calvary also, which is also a significant part of that story.
Since we don't have that much time left, I'll jump ahead and I'll ask you both this question. You know, you talk about your origins, you talk about the work that you do now. What I want to know, you know, is what do you have to say to other white people about about the work that you do? Is it something that only you can do it? Do you think that like there's a, do you extend an invitation? And if you do, what does that mean? And really, can y'all are going to laugh because this is, I guess, what I do. But like, why is what you do ministry? And why is this church? And why should church have this conversation? Why should this be the conversation on a Sunday morning, especially after the Saturday night that we just had? Why should this be the conversation that we're having?
To me, it's the only conversation. I think our belovedness, I think God's living within each of us is the only thing that matters. I think the worth of each person is the gospel. And I think us in community is the gospel. I was laughing when you said, what would you say to other white people? You know, often people in minorities, whether it's your gender or sexual orientation or race, you're often asked to speak for everyone in your affinity group. You know, what do black people think about this? You're like, I'm not all black people. You know, what do women think about this? What do, you know, what do immigrants think? There is no sort of all. But as we have been talking over the last couple of weeks about this conversation and how is it ministry, how is it gospel, my very simple response and answer is, how is it not? How can we look at anything, any example, any way that Jesus lived, taught, loved, forgave, included, radically questioned every system that was in place, and not realize it's the work that we're called to? Like, how do we not? In this scripture today that was read, everyone seems to know the question, am I my brother's keeper? That has become a part of our, you know, common knowledge and vernacular. But to me, the important part is are the four words that come before that. When God says to him, what have you done? Your brother's blood is, you know, it's crying out. Where's your brother Abel? To me, the four words that matter more than am I my brother's keeper, because the answer to that is yes, is these four words, I don't know. I do not know. A, it's a lie. You do know because you did it. But I think that is the choice that we as people of power, that's often our answer. Is the I don't know. I don't see that. I don't see color. That's not part of my. And I think it's become the shield of protection that we have used. You know, where is this pain? Where are people hurting? And I think too often the very short answer I hear from people who have similar privilege that I do will say, gosh, I don't know. I'm just going to love people. Or, I don't know. We do know. You have to work incredibly hard to not see it. You have to actively shut your eyes, close your mind, plug your ears. You have to work at it to not see it in this world. You have to work hard to not draw the lines between the shooting that happened in El Paso last night and the vitriolic hate of people of color. You have to be blind to not see that. The people who perpetrated the violence are shouting, I hate people who are immigrants. They're shouting it. He wrote a manifesto. He said, this is why I did this. And yet, the people who grew up like me, look like me, would have had their Confederate flag on the back of their truck, would say, he was just crazy. It doesn't have anything to do with that. It does. And so to me, these four words, I don't know, to me, that's the evil. To me, that's the piece of the thing that we have to own is we do know. Because when you know, when I know, I'm required to do something. If I can say I don't know, it absolves me from action. And so back to your question about what do we do. Chris and I both chose work. We actively said this is work I want to do. Not everyone can do that. There are lots of other jobs that have to be done in the world, thank goodness. Most of them I'm unable to do, so thank you for doing all the other ones. But in all of our work, I think there are things that we can see. There are things that we can know and choose to act regardless of what our vocation and career is. I think that's our calling, is in our vocational calling to then see through the lens of we do know we are our sister and our brother's keeper.
Yeah, I think Carrie's exactly right. That is an issue of seeing, and I think the only thing that I'll add is to say, I think part of the kind of sinisterness of colorblindness is not only that it puts up a veil that prevents us from seeing the effects of racism and white supremacy, but it also prevents white people from seeing that we are also formed by our whiteness in ways that perpetuate that. And so I think that kind of along with our story that we see in this biblical story, the kind of very first act of violence in the Bible, because of prejudice, Cain was jealous of Abel. For whatever reason, God preferred Abel's sacrifice, and Cain was jealous and was prejudiced against him to the point of violence. And I think the main part is that the system of white supremacy and color blindness helps to perpetuate that happening. I want to conclude with James Cone's interpretation of that passage. I think that it's appropriate since we've been looking at Cone and TOD and reading this memoir of his, and he concludes his late, Cone died last summer, right? And so some of the last words that he wrote were actually on this scripture passage. It says, Cain can be viewed as a metaphor for white people and Abel for black people. And I think we can extend that beyond just black people. God is asking white Americans, especially Christians, where are your black brothers and sisters? And whites respond, we don't know. Are we their keepers? And Lord says, what have you done to them for four centuries? The blood of black people is crying out to God and to white people from the ground in the United States of America. The blood of Sandra Bland in Texas and Tamir Rice in Ohio. Blood of the Emmanuel Nine in Charleston, South Carolina. And Eric Garner in Staten Island, New York. Blood of 20 people killed in Walmart in El Paso. The blood of Nat Turner and nearly 5,000 lynched blacks. Black blood is crying out to God all over this land. Is anybody listening to the cries of black blood, that strange fruit that Billie Holiday sang about, blood on the leaves and blood at the root? The cry of black blood that I heard during the in Detroit in 1967, more than 50 years ago, is still crying out all over America today. White people didn't hear it then, and they still don't hear it now.